everybody, to episode 55 of High Tech on the Low. 55, good number. It shows that we've been around for a while. And I'm very excited to bring in, for this double number episode, Dr. Zeev Yakutieli. Dr. Zeev. Well, we won't call you Dr. Zeev. We'll call you Zeev just today. How are you doing? How are you doing today in New York?
Doing great.
Amazing. Amazing. It's really exciting to having you here with us on the podcast. You know, it's been a little bit since we've talked, and I'm really excited to have you with us. And as always, we're supported by Front Team with 12 communities, 6 verticals, and 3,000 people all looking to connect. And what's really exciting, I think, about this specific episode is really the kind of industry that we're looking at, right? This whole world of neuroscience, this whole world of kind of how neuroscience and electronics and everything like that come together to understand how to kind of better, you know, I would say utilize the world around us in a certain sense and also make benefit from it. So, you know, Dr. Yakutieli, Zeev, I think we'll go with Zeev for the interview if that's okay.
Please do.
Awesome. You know, I would love to just understand a little bit more about who's the man behind the title and who's the man behind the startup. And let's get it going. We'll start asking some interesting questions.
Okay. So a brief introduction about myself. I've been connecting between technology and neurology for now more than 20 years, starting with my engineering degree in electrical engineering at the Technion. I think it was already in the second semester that I realized that this is something that I want to do. So in parallel to the regular studies of electrical engineering, I took courses in biology and chemistry and neurophysiology. Sure. And all of that. And then even in my first degree, the projects that I did were related. So connecting between physiological signals that picks up the movement of your lips and fingers. And it turned out to be a project that we called a virtual trumpet. So a computer will identify the EMG signals and then realize which tone you're trying to play, because it's a combination of fingers and lips. And then another project using gold coated nanowires to connect between chips and transistors and neurons. And then in my second degree, connecting between a PC and a multi electrode array of ex vivo neurons. And then in my PhD, connecting between other more advanced models of ex vivo neural networks and electrocorticography from epilepsy. So a lot of
it sounds like you have a lot of, I mean, it's a lot of kind of unique and diverse applications of these different kind of, like, what I would say, like, combinations of neurotechnology, right? Evaluating something that's coming with us, with our neurosystem, and dealing with some type of electronic feedback mechanism that gives you some idea of what's going on. Now, also, you talked to a very specific point of mine that I love, which is the trumpet. I was a trumpet player, so I love that you did that. So I think, well, you know, I stopped only because my parents told me it was going so loud in the house that I had to stop. But now I dibble dabble here and there, you know what I mean? but I'd love to see actually what you did on another episode. We can talk about that. But I want to know how then you moved into Montfort. You know, how did we kind of get from, you know, it sounds like you started in a very different space, which was music, basically, in your bachelor's at least. And now you've moved into this space of neuroscience kind of and really, you know, care in a sense. Right. So how was the move?
So it wasn't music. It was science primarily, to try to understand how neurons work and how do they connect and what's happening in different neurological conditions. How is epilepsy caused by the neurological properties of the brain, for example? So it was science around understanding how neurons function. And because essentially there are electrical and chemical properties, the signals, it's very, to me, it was very immediate to try to connect between the two. So, but that was, let's say, my academic career. And in parallel, I've been working as an electrical engineer for a company dealing with avionics, and then for Intel in Haifa, in the Israel Design Center in Haifa, and handling things totally unrelated to the brain. And at some point, I think it was a result of what I did in the lab that I was a part of in my master's degree, that I thought that Intel can design a chip that will utilize the very advanced technology that Intel develops as a CPU,
right,
and add another layer that will allow this chip to connect to neurons. And then you can have a chip that you can implant on people's brain. And this will solve a very big problem that now is limiting brain machine interface. And of course, a lot of the treatment that it can offer. And it's primarily the bandwidth and power efficiency problem. It's very difficult now to get enough data from the brain outside,
sure,
manipulate it, and maybe activate muscles or stimulate or these kind of things. And I thought that Intel can contribute to that by offering a very efficient computation on a chip that can be implanted on the brain. And at some point, I got to talk with one of the, I think, most brilliant neurologists and scientists that I
at Intel, or this is just separately?
No, separately.
Okay.
In Hadassah, in Jerusalem, I've been in contact with them.
So you were in cahoots with people in the medical field already, kind of. Okay.
Exactly, because it's most of the things that you do in science in terms of the brain, they are still in, if there are any applications, it's for the medical world.
Okay.
Still not a lot of technology companies driven development in this regard. So I shared my ideas, and he told me that with all due respect, every couple of months, an engineer like myself comes up with another thing that you can design and put in people's brain and stuff like that.
That happens all the time, you're saying. Basically, everyone's just putting things in people's brains.
No, people think about doing that.
Right.
People like myself and other people in that domain,
okay,
realize the potential that these kind of products can, that they can be helpful for addressing a lot of different conditions. And in fact, there are already some applications for epilepsy,
sure,
and Parkinson, etc. But he told me that the main thing that they need is something entirely different, and it's the knowing what's going on with the patients in their real lives. And he showed me a patient that came to a visit, and then that person would be evaluated very often in the corridor, because if you want to check how this person is walking, the office is not...
Right, you're not walking in an office. You're walking in the hallway. Exactly.
You go outside to the hallway, and then you ask people to please step aside, and then you put a chair, and then you stand up and walk, and then you go back to the office, and they ask the patient to hold your hand and see the
sure.
tremor and some drawings and questionnaires. So it's very time consuming for the physician. It's very subjective by nature,
sure,
the assessment, and it doesn't represent the patient in their real life. It's just
mm-hmm.
a snapshot in time, in a random time.
Right.
That appointment was made 3 months ago. The hour is totally random.
Right.
The patient may fluctuate between the morning to the noon, and even in a shorter interval.
Right. Maybe he didn't have breakfast in the morning, makes it hard for him to do his thing. Right. You know.
Sleep. How long did he spend on the bus
right,
driving
right.
To cramped, you know, sitting like that? Sometimes even in over flights. And also there is the white coat effect.
Right. Like when you're with the doctor, I've heard of this before. Kind of like when you're with the doctor, you do better or you do worse even sometimes.
Exactly.
You know?
It affects the way that you perform. And this,
right.
all of these problems are manifested in most of the conditions, but in neurological conditions where the brain is the subject of the evaluation, this is even, this will have a much stronger impact. So all of these problems reduce the quality of assessment that the neurologist even after they spend a lot of time and try to do the best, they have a relatively poor assessment for the patient condition. And as a result, the treatment that they assign is less effective than it can be. It's always, the treatment is constantly being adjusted based on the patient condition.
But you're telling me that up until now, it's basically based off of me showing up, showing the doctor what's going on with me, and then him saying, okay, you need to do X, Y, or Z, or take X, Y, or Z, and that's it.
Exactly. That's the only way that they can do it. Even with more advanced technology, like the part of which that I mentioned, like deep brain stimulation.
Right. Okay.
These are, it's, you need to understand that technology that is involved in generating local, very specific position stimulation within the brain, the technology that it takes to map the brain, the imaging technologies, the electrode themselves, you implant the pacemaker on the chest, and then there are wires that goes and reach to with electrodes.
Right.
It's insane. And I know, because from my experience as an engineer, I know what it takes to get that image, to get those electrodes in place. It's insane. But then the patient walks out of the operation room and no one knows what's going on with them and how to calibrate the electrodes to work at as best as they can. It's the same with drugs. There's a lot of the different ways to take the drugs, with pumps or with pills or with injections, different combinations of drugs. It's impossible for the patient, for the physician, to know the outcome of the treatment setting.
Unless they're doing a general follow-up, basically what you're saying, like all the time, basically.
Throughout the patient life, and in neurological conditions, it can be several decades.
Wow.
That they constantly need to monitor the patient, and they're doing the best. Sometimes you can't do too much change, but even, especially when you look at large number, even if you reduce the risk of falls, for example, by 1%, this will be thousands of people that don't fall and don't break the hip and can keep on living. And of course, the economical burden will be huge.
I mean, I love myself what you just said there, I think, with that whole idea that even solving just a little bit saves a lot. And one of the things I kind of want to understand here too is that, so when you came with your idea, you basically said, I want to kind of revolutionize this entire basically patient care model. I'm not only providing kind of the whole new technology to kind of monitor, but I'm actually helping you guys have real-time feedback of what's going on.
So I don't think that we do a revolution. I think it's an evolution.
Ooh, I like that. Okay, explain yourself a little bit.
So especially in and if any startupist is listening, then if I can contribute one thing for anyone that's in the medical world, is that you cannot, and this is what I thought that I can do in the beginning, you cannot invent any new test. You cannot invent and convince people to change the way the symptoms that they were looking at and the ways that they were looking at. That would be a revolution. And it takes a huge company to be able to do that.
Okay.
As a startup, we do an evolution. And the evolution that we're doing is, first of all, to learn which are the tests that neurologists currently rely upon in their assessment at the clinic.
Okay.
These are the tests that I've witnessed in the corridor with the chair, walking, the test of all the device like that, or draw something. They're familiar with these tests. The patients are familiar with these tests. These are the medical standards. All the publications are based on that. Drugs are checked with those tests.
Right.
So you don't invent, we do not invent any test. We develop a digital manner to run the same test in a digital way. So in our case, we use the smartphone to run, record the same test, the same walking test, the same tremor test, the same cognitive test, all of which are done now instead of the physician using a stopwatch or just observing or using a piece of paper, we use the sensors that exist in the smartphone in order to conduct the same tests. So the first stage of this evolution was to show them that we were able to run those tests that they're used to the clinic as they are used to in exactly the same way and give them matching results to begin with and more accurate ones.
Well, that I love right there because, you know, you're talking about kind of something that I think a lot of people, and sometimes, you know, they overshoot, right? In that you kind of come in and you say, you know, as you say, I'm going to reinvent the wheel. I'm going to change the entire makeup of an industry. And you're almost not having the respect for the industry as is. And you're coming in, you're saying, hey, we're here. We're going to go with your process, but we're going to digitize it, make it automatic, you know, make it more automated in a sense, and make it in a way so that you can have real, you know, real actual results from this that we can actually say, hey, this is actually how you can make your whole process better and help people. Now, the one thing I want to kind of ask Steve is, you know, you're bringing this idea to, obviously, I mean, you're very successful. You're in New York right now. You've made very big, you know, leaps forward in your company. How is it initially approaching investors with this type of, you know, model, basically? Because, you know, in a sense, it's you know, a hard kind of sell, right? You're talking about diseases that are neuroscience diseases, not always things people are constantly impacted with or see all the time. And at the same time, it's very advanced technology. It also has this kind of Black Mirror image, right? You know, of something like having a chip in your head, right? Which is like, you know, terrible, right? No one necessarily wants a chip in their head, as we know from the pandemic, and no one wants to get injected with the chip. So how do you kind of, you know, how did you kind of sell this to investors and kind of bring this to them in a way that they can understand?
First of all, one of the things that we find challenging when presenting it to investors is people tend to think that neurological conditions are rare and that they are only occurring at a very late stage of the life, which is entirely false.
Right.
Neurological conditions, and we address psychiatric conditions as neurological conditions as well. It's just a, I would say, a branch in neurological conditions. It all happens in the brain. It's just the more complicated conditions that I would say are manifested in a broader range of the brain connectivity, etc., that affects the behavior. So, but it still it all happens in the brain. So. Especially if you take into account psychiatric conditions, most of the patients are relatively young,
right?
And they live with these conditions for decades. So this is the first thing that we had to explain to people, that it affects hundreds of millions of people. Almost 1 out of 9 people now suffer from a condition related to the brain. And these numbers will grow with the aging of population.
Wow.
And very often...
That's a huge number. I have to be honest. I didn't even know that.
It's a huge number. And then people that think that it's rare, like yesterday, I met with a couple of people. One, his mother and mother-in-law.
Right.
Both have different neurological conditions. And then another guy that his daughter has a neurological condition. So... when they think about it, they say, hey, you know what? I do know a lot of people who suffer from this condition. So that's one thing that it took some time to explain, but people understand it, and you can't argue with the number.
It sounds like a bit of market education there, right? Like you had to actually teach people like what you think as this stigma about neuroscience, psychological disorders, whatever it might be. This is real and exists in a high number.
Correct. So people tend to think that neurological conditions are much more rare than many other conditions, and it's not. You need to show them the numbers. That's a part of the problem in general. Neurological conditions have kind of a stigma, of a negative stigma. You don't blame anyone for having like a heart condition, but people with Parkinson's disease or schizophrenia or bipolar disorder, very often they're embarrassed with their condition.
Right, and everyone blames it on them, right? They say, you know, you were boxing too much as a kid, so you got Parkinson's, or you did this, and so you got this thing. Yeah, I know the whole story, exactly.
So it's that's a part of the problem. The people don't realize the magnitude of this condition. Second problem was the thing that people said, you won't be able to change the neurologist's mind,
right?
Because they are very conservative, even I think more than other disciplines in medicine, and for a good reason, because
right.
It's very difficult to understand anything about the brain. So once you understand it, you stick to it.
Right.
So this is why our way of introducing the solution, picking tests and markers that they are familiar with, doing first the validation in the clinic.
Right.
Then when they trust it, we can do the tests at home, and they can still trust it because
right.
they see that it's accurate. So that was the second part of, I think, that was a challenge. And finally, and this is the challenge that Montfort and other companies in this area are still meeting, is the monetization of this solution.
Sure.
Because even now that we have a very good, validation, a lot of publications, key neurologists that use and rely our technology.
Right, you have the social proof, you have the academic like reliance, but you're basically still saying you're not getting the money through part.
We have FDA clearance,
right.
Even for most of the tests that we have, and we have growing demand from companies that need this kind of, and hospitals
right.
that need this kind of solution. But it's still, the entire ecosystem is still not clear now as for how will this solution be scaling out to all of those millions, hundreds of millions of patients that I'm mentioning.
Right.
It's still not a standard that all the hospitals have to apply. There's still telehealth companies still don't have a neurological disorder branch because they lack this tool. So it's a chicken and egg solution.
Do you see like some, do you also kind of see like telehealth moving forward in the future? Because now that we're all kind of suddenly coming back to the office and physical stuff, I mean, is it still going to continue?
It's going to continue and grow. Day two companies, big companies like Teladoc and Amwell and the like, they realize that they need to adapt to changes. Maybe things won't grow as fast as they can, but that ship has already sailed.
Right. Okay. So we're yours, in your mind, telehealth is the future, basically.
There's no other alternative. Mm-hmm. Simply, if people like it or not, there's no other alternative. For the mere fact of the economical burden of the current way of
right.
doing business, it's not going to hold. It's not holding now. It starts by the we see it. I see it in the States, also in Israel. It's with the aging of population, and there are less new neurologists getting into the system. The problem is worsening. So
wow.
It does, and the first impact is you see that the quality of care is reducing, because if you must rely upon clinical visits and you have less neurologists for more patients,
this is like your only solution then, in my mind. I mean, you know what I mean? Like, that's how I see it.
It's the only solution, and you already see the quality of care in many countries reducing, costs increasing.
Wow.
People need to spend more money to get an appointment.
Right.
So and at the same time, the payers are driving money into remote patient monitoring solution. They understand that that's the only way of solving this problem. If you look at the USA and Germany, if you look at China, for example, their goal is that 90% of the people that now are being examined in the clinic at the hospital will be examined at home. 7% will be monitored in the local services. The only 3% will keep on going to the hospital for the more severe cases. That's the only, it doesn't matter what we want to do. That's the only way we can do it.
Well, it also sounds like you're really, you're hitting the market too, where it needs to be right now. You know, it sounds like everything is pointed in that direction, whether it's the less amount of people getting into the field, meaning that you don't have the experts to deal with, or the hospitals and these other centers, we can say, that are kind of pushing people to do things at home, do things remotely, get their help remotely, which I think is very interesting how you guys hit that market point really specifically.
Correct. So the main challenge is to figure out exactly how will this evolve? Who will, like in 10 years from now...
Well, I pose the question to you. How will it evolve?
So I think that there are two main forces that will that need to find their balance to get this from top to bottom. So Montfort is doing it, this effort bottom up.
Okay.
To work with the hospitals that can prescribe the remote patient monitoring to the patients.
Right.
We work with companies like Medtronic or Teva that look for this kind of a companion to their drugs and medical devices so that when they make a sale, the patient will benefit from this kind of a solution.
Like a more comprehensive solution in that sense.
Correct. If you buy our drug, you will get a monitor. Your physician will be able to know what's going on with your life without the need for you to go to the clinic.
Sounds
and
excellent.
There's a lot of other advantages.
Yeah.
But I think that the main change is going to be driven from the payer side and the telehealth companies, because if Teladoc decides that she would like to open a branch of teleneurology, like they have telecardiology and telediabetes and teleobesity, tele.
Right.
If they decide that they want to invest in teleneurology, they can offer this kind of services to millions of patients.
Wow.
And then they can bring into this the payers that need to start getting used to for reimbursement for teleneurology. What they're already doing for telecardiology or telediabetes, it will take some time for them to accept the fact that this is what can be applied, the same model can be applied.
But they have the model. They have what to base it on. Right.
Yeah. There's no real, in the sense of the paradigm of the treatment, there's no real difference between offering telecardiology and teleneurology. Neurology is much more complicated, and the brain has a lot of different functions than just the physical properties of the heart.
Right.
So we have cognitive indicators and affective indicators and motor control, etc. But essentially, if you're able to put a neurologist, just like his colleague, the cardiologist,
right,
and provide all the data that this neurologist need in order to adjust the treatment or simply say, you know what, you're doing great. I think we've hit the optimum that we can obtain for your age and your gender, and because we also have the big data to show this.
Right.
So you don't need to come to the clinic. That's great. You're doing fine. The new treatment is working. We're happy. So the same paradigm can be applied for neurologists if they have this tool like Montfort is providing.
Right.
To connect between them remotely.
Well, that I love too, because there's this whole, you know, you're bringing up this whole idea of like the decentralization of medical services, right? That I don't need to just go to the hospital to the doctor. I can actually have, in a sense, the old time method of the family doctor coming and visit you, but now I can have it for everyone. I can have the cardiologist. I can have the neurologist in Montfort's case. I can have anyone. And I love that idea. Now, we're getting towards the end of the podcast, and I want to end it on a note of where, you know, you kind of discussed how, you know, you've developed this, where it came from, how you see it going forward. And you brought a very good point about how startupists and people who are founders themselves need to think. So I'm kind of going to change the normal question, which is, what do you think all entrepreneurs need to focus on now? Like, what's your key advice to more like, what is your thing that you think you wish you had known going into this that you want to tell people about now? I know it's a deep question.
It's a deep question. I would tell you personally something that I very often think about, that if Montfort was, for example, even my second startup,
right,
then all of my experience, the time that it took for me to learn things from the business point of view,
right,
I've already known that. So I came to Montfort with a very strong knowledge of science and the medical of neurology and technology. That I was very strong in all of these and was very well connected as well in these domains. But it was the first startup that I started. So a lot of the things that took us more time to realize, now I know that I could have made it better. So I don't know if it's something practical, but if you're a startupist and you have a very good idea, maybe start with your second best idea.
I like that.
Try it out first, learn, build a team around it,
and see how it goes.
And then move to the thing, to the one thing that can change the world and help hundreds of millions of people, and then you'll do it faster. I don't think it's something that
So if I can summarize it, it sounds like start with your exit, finish with your unicorn, right? That's the idea here.
And even if you don't exit at the first startup, it will increase dramatically the chances of your second one to succeed. Unfortunately, I started with the one thing that I wanted to do and the one thing that I think can really make a big impact. So we're trying to fix the mistake that I've made in the past as we go.
Well, it sounds like you're doing a really good job, and I really do. I congratulate you. It sounds like you guys are really moving up. So, Ziv, I really want to say thank you so much for taking the time. Dr. Ziv Yekutieli, everyone from Montfort, you should definitely check them out. They're going places. Very innovative company. And really, I thank you for your time, Ziv.
Thank you.